members of the Stamitz Quartet played that terzetto, or trio, by Antonín Dvořák.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Thank you for tuning in, and hope you're enjoying this lovely, lovely programming. Speaking of lovely programming, mark this date on your calendar, Friday, March the 6th, 2009. Yes, that is the official date of the next performance of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra, Friday, March the 6th. Guest pianist and conductor Rich Reidenauer will present the annual Pops Concert. This really is just a don't-miss opportunity to feel the passion at the beautiful Ford Community and Performing Arts Center as we enjoy the annual Pops Concert of the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra. If you'd like to go on the Dearborn Symphony website, you can learn more about this concert or other upcoming performances as well, and that is simply by typing into your computer www.dearbornsymphony.org or call the box office 313-565-2424. That's 565-2424. See you there.
Hi, I'm Gillian.
Good morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. in the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you, Melissa. Well, our guest for today's program is Viken Chaterian, who is a Geneva-based researcher working at Samara, a Swiss think tank. He holds a PhD from the Graduate Institute of Geneva. He has worked as a correspondent in the Middle East and later in the Caucasus, Central Asia, Russia, and the Ukraine, reporting for legal European papers. Leading European papers. His research interests include conflicts, peace building, nationalism, transition, and democratization, as well as environmental and security. He is the founder of the Caucasus Media Institute in Yerevan, Armenia, which he directed from 2002 to 2005. Viken Chaterian's latest book, entitled War and Peace in the Caucasus, Russia's Troubled Frontier, was published by Hearst in Britain in 2008 and will appear in the U.S. early in 2009 from Columbia University Press. Copies of the book will be available for sale, and the author will be signing copies following his many lectures. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Caucasus was wrecked by ethnic and separatist violence as the peoples of the region struggled for often conflicting claims of self-determination. Viken Chaterian, who spent many years as a reporter and analyst in the region, will discuss the emergence of nationalism as a dominant political force in the area. He will also address the causes of the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh, Abkhazia, and Chechnya, as well as the August War of 2008 in Georgia, various diplomatic attempts over the years, and their failures to achieve peace in these conflicts will be covered today as well. Viken, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me here. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure arranging to have your flight from Geneva actually land in a snowstorm today, and you're here on time. Well, we're going to begin. The essence of today's program is following the First World War and the disillusionment of three very prominent empires that had within its borders several minorities. And, of course, these minorities are all yearning to be free and independent. We have the Austro-Hungarian Empire that fell apart in the subsequent creation of Yugoslavia, which means the Southern Slavs, and the creation after World War I of all the various states from Czechoslovakia. Now we have the Czechs and the Slovaks dividing and the creation of Yugoslavia. We have Slovenes, Slovaks, Bosnians, who, as I understand it, are just Muslims of the same people. They all speak the same Serbo-Croatian language. We have Croatians and, of course, Serbians, Albanians, Macedonians, and their similarities. Viken is going to try to make some sense out of all of that. So when you hear about these conflicts in Kosovo and who are the Kosovars and what happened in the 15th century when the Turkish army came and occupied that part of the world and subsequently Islamized these very tall, blue-eyed, blonde people that people don't figure in Europe could be Muslims. And then we're going to go from there to the Caucasus with the disillusionment of the Turkish Ottoman Empire and the establishment of the state of Turkey and subsequently the establishment of the state of Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan, which comes out of the disillusionment of the Russian Tsarist Empire. So these things are kind of all connected, and you see the problems of them today, and Viken's going to make sense out of these. So when you hear the news program that says Armenians and Turks not getting along and Azeris, now you'll have some idea. There's a reason for it, and they usually go back at least to the turn of the century, to the First World War, but beyond that, ethnically, religiously, and culturally. Viken, welcome. I did all the talking I need to do to introduce you, what we're going to talk about, and it's up to you to lead us however you'd like to start, if you'd like to begin in Kosovo.
Yeah, thank you very much. I started working in the Caucasus region practically some weeks after the collapse of the USSR. And at the time, it was very difficult to understand what was happening. We were discovering a whole region which was completely unknown in the West. Neither Europeans nor Americans knew about the peoples and ethnic groups inhabiting the Caucasus. And we were discovering them as one conflict succeeded the other. Karabakh, Ossetia, Abkhazia, the Georgians, the Armenians, the Azeris, and then the conflicts moved to the North Caucasus, the North Ossetians, the Ingush, the Chechens, the Dagestanis. And of course, it was very difficult to make sense out of all these events.
And they're all different peoples, at least. Some are Muslim, some are Christian, some are intermixed, too.
Yeah, basically at the time we didn't know about these people more than that. We knew that some are Muslim, some speak Caucasian languages, others speak Indo-European languages, but our knowledge about the region was very, very limited. So the easiest thing to do was to say there are conflicts now because historically these people didn't go along well. And then there were the Soviets repressing any kind of political expression. And once the Soviet Union weakened and collapsed, now we go back to the natural state, which is to see these people fighting each other. And somehow this kind of interpretation puts me ill at ease. I don't find that these people have to be enemies all the time. And even if they are different, even if they speak different languages, they have different ethnic background, they have different religious beliefs, this doesn't mean that they can't live peacefully with each other. And even when we go back to history, we see that during most of history, they managed very well to live together peacefully. And So the question was, why did we have conflicts at that moment? And I think for me, the most important point to make here is that the years 91, 92, we were going through very particular moments in history. There was a state at the time, which was the Soviet Union, which was a very particular kind of state, very very much built on military power, that scared the whole world. The Soviet Union was feared, was considered to be a superpower, and
And they kept all those minorities in line in their jurisdiction.
Yes, obviously. Of course. And suddenly this very top-down state, very militarized state, weakened and very rapidly collapsed. And what was left behind was disillusionment, was disorder. People couldn't make sense of what was happening. People didn't understand how they are going to go on living, how they are going to continue managing their economies, and so on. And what kind of political system should they build to replace this this state? And I would argue that the same happened in Yugoslavia. So the conflicts we have in the Balkans and the Caucasus are the direct result of the collapse of very particular kind of states that we had, Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union.
Well, Yugoslavia has to do with the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, slightly different than what happened in the Caucasus. But where would you like to begin? Would you like to begin in the Caucasus or begin with the Kosovars? Most people hear the story of Kosovo, the Kosovars, and the argument, what the Serbians did, Milosevic. They don't understand what that's all about. Can you give some...
I would argue that the conflicts that we had in the Balkans and the Caucasus were of similar type. We had central authorities which defined their state out of ethnic national criteria. Serbia was dominated by Serbs, and in this state, Albanian-speaking Kosovars had an underprivileged position. We had the same thing in the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was also divided into territories, and each territory was attributed to an ethnic group. Of course, on the top of this hierarchy were the Russian ethnic group. But also within the republics, for example, in Armenia, in Soviet Armenia, the Armenians were considered to be the dominant group. And other minorities didn't have the same rights in Soviet Armenia as the Armenians.
Well, Armenia was about 98% Armenian.
That's why...
Most of the republics... I don't think Georgians were 60% of the state of Georgia.
That's right. What I'm trying to say is that it was the same system, but because in Armenia there were smaller minorities than in other places, it didn't become a major problem. But in countries like Georgia or Azerbaijan, this was more problematic. In the Soviet Union, the first mass national movement started in Azerbaijan. More precisely in mountainous Karabakh, Nagorno-Karabakh, which had a majority of ethnic Armenians, and the region in the Soviet period enjoyed an autonomous status. Still, in spite of having this autonomous status, the Armenian inhabitants of Karabakh were not satisfied with their rights, and they felt that they were underprivileged and that they didn't enjoy the same rights as other citizens of Azerbaijan. And that's why in 1988, when there was Gorbachev coming to power and promising transparency and reconstruction of the Soviet state.
Glasnost and perestroika.
In Russian, that's right.
In Russian.
So the Armenians thought that it was time to express their political wishes and desires, and that's what they did.
All they wanted to do was join the Republic of Armenia. They didn't want to change anything.
Yes, but...
the Azeris didn't like that.
That's right. I think...
What's the percentage of Azeris in Azerbaijan? Is it like Georgia, the very low percentage or a high percentage?
Probably now it's above 90%.
I mean then, at the dissolution of the Soviet Union.
I don't have the figures in mind, but I would think between 80% and 85%.
So its ethnic population was primarily Turkish. The Azeris are Turks. They speak Turkish. The Georgians are Christians and they speak Georgian, but in Georgia they were not they were barely a majority, 60% or so.
They were
there's the Abkhazians, yeah. The Ossetians and those issues. How does the conflict that we see the average person hears more about? Well, I guess lately they've been hearing more about Georgia, but our last program we talked about Georgia a little bit. The Kosovar situation, can you shed some light on why the Serbs were so much anxious to reoccupy Kosovo?
For many people, the contemporary conflicts in the Balkans started from Kosovo. Started with the contradictions between Milosevic and his regime and the Albanians who wanted more self-rule and having more rights. This was the late 80s, and afterwards we had a number of wars in former Yugoslavia. And the last major war was when there was increasing repression of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo by Milosevic, and eventually NATO bombarding Serbia to kind of force Serbia out of Kosovo, imagining that would be a solution for the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
Why did
at the
they
time.
Want Kosovo? Which was not Kosovo wasn't it part of the it was not part of Serbia when it was the Yugoslavian Republic, right?
Kosovo was part of Serbia within Yugoslavia, but what was urgent in 1999, which led to the war, NATO war against Yugoslavia, was that Milosevic was pushing ethnic Albanians out of Kosovo, and there were hundreds of thousands of refugees moving out of Kosovo and going to neighboring Albania, and in Europe. There was a fear that this will cause major crises, not just in
genocide.
Maybe massacres, genocide, but also that there will be huge waves of refugees moving from Serbia, Albania to West European countries.
So these are the Albanians are primarily Muslims, but there's a small percentage of them that are Christians. You use the term Albanians. The when we talk about Bosnia and the Bosnians, are they Albanians as well?
No, the Bosnians they are not Albanians. They are ethnically very close to Croats and Serbs, but they are Muslim.
I see. Yeah. So really, they're not much different as a people. They are ethnically the same people. So in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they had Bosnia and Herzegovina. Those were districts that they created. It just so happens that in the district of Bosnia, the Muslims were a majority of these ethnically same people. Is that right?
Yes. And
because the Bosnians wanted to separate and create, separate from Serbia as well.
Yes, once the Yugoslav state started weakening and falling apart, then all the units that were making part of this federation, they had basically no other choice but to create their own states, independent states.
Okay, as close as I can tell, according to my watch, we're about a quarter away through the program, and it's time to give a station identification. You are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM on your dial, and that's the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, broadcasting from Dearborn, Michigan. And you are listening to today's program called Then and Now on How History Affects Current Events. And I am your host, Ned Apigian, and our guest today from Switzerland and Geneva is Professor Vikan Chatarian, and he's trying to give us some insight into the issues of the collapse of the Soviet Union and its effect in the Caucasus, primarily. And Vikan, I'll let you carry on with that. How would you like to characterize that very broad subject? It's very complicated.
Yes, it's very complicated because after the 1999 war, the NATO forces took over Kosovo. 16,000 soldiers were stationed there. There was a UN mandate to run the affairs of Kosovo. And with time, both NATO and the UN came to the conclusion that they are unable to carry on with running the affairs of Kosovo without finding a solution to the question of the status. And they came to the conclusion that the inhabitants, the majority of Kosovo inhabitants, the Kosovars, Albanian-speaking Kosovars, they would not wish to be put again under the rule of Belgrade. So I think sometime 2 or 3 years ago, there was a decision among Western leaders that the solution for the Kosovo problem was to give independent status to Kosovo, which happened in February 2008 when Kosovo declared itself independent and leading European states as well as the U.S. recognized Kosovo as independent.
So how big is Kosovo and what's its population?
Its population is...
Does it be the size of Armenia or smaller?
It's just 2 million, and the area, I don't remember exactly the area, but it's a small
so would you say country. It's smaller than Armenia?
It's smaller than Armenia, yes, okay. That's right.
Now, how about the Bosnians? Do they got a country now called Bosnia?
That's right. Bosnia is an independent state and member of the UN.
Okay. Croatia is an independent state.
That's right. So there's no controversy in Bosnia and Croatia, but there's a huge controversy around Kosovo because neither Serbia nor Russia recognized Kosovo as independent, and they were not happy about it.
Okay.
And the Russians threatened, saying that in case the West recognizes and pushes for Kosovo recognition, then this can have repercussions elsewhere.
Right, and it did in Georgia this
That's
summer.
Right. Yeah.
The Russians taught the Georgian American-educated president that he was not going to go mucking about with the Ossetians. And most people don't know who the Ossetians are. Yeah. And
but I would like to say something about American-educated Georgian president who truly did spend some time at Columbia University.
Obviously, he's a fool.
but he's also Soviet-educated. I mean, he has also a degree in international relations from Kiev, and before that he studied.
He had his foot in both worlds then.
Yes, absolutely.
And misread everybody.
And I wonder why American journalists would always like to remind us that he spent some semesters in Colombia, and we forget that he also did a degree in international relations in Kiev, Ukraine, in Soviet times. So he has both Soviet and American education.
That's something I learned for sure. Maybe that's why he's foolish. Well, anyway, he decided that he was going to attack the Ossetians and force them into line, I guess. But what interests me more about all this is, since we're talking about what's happening, the question is why? Why so far back in the darkness of history do we have this? We understand the Bosnians are the same people. It's not until the Turks came into that part of Europe that they Islamized these people and substantially made them different. from their Christian brethren, because they're essentially the same people. They speak the same language, Serbo-Croatian, although I think the Kosovars also speak Turkish, too. I know myself, I met Yugoslavs in the Middle East when I was working there. They were Turkish-speaking. They thought of themselves as Turks. I thought that was strange, but at the time I didn't understand the difference.
In Kosovo, there's a small Turkic minority who are ethnically Turk, consider themselves to be Turk, and they speak Turkish. But they are a very small minority, and very often they feel closer to the ethnic Serb minority of Kosovo rather than feeling closer to the Kosovo Albanians. It's very curious.
Mm.
I mean, I don't like to create this kind of very fixed identities and going back to history and looking at historical confrontations and then projecting the future as a continuation of the past. I think during these troubled years of the collapse of socialism in Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. including the collapse of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union, there were different ways of managing the political space and the creation of new political space, because these societies were confronted by huge challenges. How to redefine your society? Who's in, who's out? What are the rules?
Well, you know what? People being people, when Milosevic can say 500 years ago, when it was that famous battle, they lost the battle in Kosovo, it resonates with them. What you're talking about makes intellectual sense, maybe, but
it resonates
when you're able to go to the people and say, look, this is what they did to me 500 years ago, and I want it back, and there isn't a Serbian left in Kosovo, but I'm going to take it back. Now you begin to understand why they want it back, because they thought something was taken from them.
It did resonate, this kind of discourses, in the past, especially in difficult times. I don't think Serbs would be very much keen to listen to this kind of speeches today. I think these times are over. And
because they got a good bombing from the Americans. I guess they don't want to hear that now.
That's one of the reasons, but apart from that, the policies that Milosevic adopted didn't lead to any good results, and the Serb population of different regions, including Bosnia, including Croatia, including now in Kosovo, they suffered a lot from this mm-hmm. kind of confrontational policies. And even if Serbs lost a battle 500 years back, it doesn't mean that they had to use the same policies and confronting in a military sense all their neighbors. They also had the choice of having different policies and different ways of solving problems.
Well, apparently the Serbians did not want to see Yugoslavia fall apart. It was not in their interest, but the Croatians wanted to separate, and you could see the Czechs and the Slovaks separated very nicely. I don't know what their argument was, do you happen to know, but they decided they were going to separate, and they were not a problem to the rest of the world. They were agreeable to each other. Apparently some people are not able to do that as well.
Absolutely, there are different kinds of divorces, right? And when there are two state units that want to separate,
the Czechs and the Slovaks handled the situation without it being a crisis.
Yes, and
the others are not able to. What do you predict with the Ossetians,
the
Abkhazians? What do you think they're going to do with the Georgians?
My feeling is that the conflicts which were there in Abkhazia and South Ossetia were getting in the right direction during Shevardnadze's time. Although Shevardnadze didn't have a consistent policy of addressing these issues, still he didn't use violence as a means to find a solution.
Are these people significantly different, the Abkhazians and the Ossetians? I understand they're mixed. There's some Christian, there's some Muslim in both groupings. But they obviously feel alienated from the Georgians.
Yes.
And what is the reason for that? That's what I want to get to in all these things, that the average person can understand, that people like you have some historical basis in fact to try to make this understandable.
Yeah. The basic differences are linguistic differences. So the Abkhaz speak a different language compared to the Georgians.
Mm-hmm.
So do the Ossets. So the Ossets speak an Iranian language. Different than the Abkhazian. The Abkhaz speak a Caucasian, West Caucasian language.
What does that mean when you say a Caucasian language?
A Caucasian language, it's a group of languages which is different from, for example, Indo-European languages or Semitic languages. So it's a group of languages in itself.
Okay, and Armenian, Armenia is in the Caucasus. The Armenians speak Armenian, which is supposed to be a branch of the Indo-European languages. Would you consider Armenian a Caucasus language?
No, Armenian, as you said, belongs to Indo-European family of languages.
How about Georgian?
Georgian is a Caucasian language.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're listening to Georgian, and you and I not knowing Georgian, would it sound more... how about the Kurds? The Kurdish, as I understand, is very much more like Armenian in its syntax than it is Turkish.
Yes, because... Kurdish language is
also Aryan Indo-European.
Yeah. Unlike the Turkic family of languages.
Yeah, are Mongolian in its base, the Turkic languages. If you go to China and there's these Turkic languages are spoken throughout Central Asia.
Yeah, Turkic languages are spoken in Central Asia, but Mongolian language is a different language family. It's true. Turkish language is linked to other Turkic languages. For example, the Azerbaijani, the Kyrgyz, the Kazakh, the Uzbek, and so on.
All right. That brings me to another subject that you've spoken about is the Chechens. What on earth are they? We hear so much of the revolutions, the Russians had to kill them in the school, the auditorium, they put gas. Who are the Chechens? Are they also a Caucasian people? If Chechen is outside of the Caucasus, where would you consider them? They speak a Caucasian language? Is it a Turkic language?
They speak a Caucasian language, the Chechens, and they live in the northern slopes of the Caucasus mountain chain, between Dagestan and Ingushetia. And I would say Chechens are impressive people, very strong characters and very rebellious. They have, I was always impressed by the Chechens each time I met with them.
And the Russians can't manage them.
The Russians can't manage them, and the Chechens are very rebellious. And
why won't they just let Chechen be another... They let all the other republics go, Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan. Why not let the Chechens go? Why? Who needs it?
Yes, that's a very valid question. The reason why Russia does not let Chechnya go is that Chechnya is part of the Russian Federation.
So what?
Which means that with the collapse of the USSR, the Russian Federation became a new state, and they let go other states that were part of the Soviet Union, like Armenia or Uzbekistan or Belarus.
Ukraine or Belarus.
Yeah.
Right.
And Russia, in the early 1990s, in the times of Yeltsin, they feared in case they let Chechnya go, there will be other regions within the Russian Federation that will ask also for independence.
Because Russia is a federation obviously made up with other similar Chechen-like places.
That's right. And one of the big fears was, in fact, that Tatarstan, which is a republic within Russia, in the Middle Volga, which is a very industrial republic with some oil deposits there, the Russians feared that Tatarstan would also want
so
to
what
become independent.
So what would be left is the Principality of St. Petersburg.
And Moscow.
And Moscow.
Yeah, so there was this kind of fears. That's why Russia, you know...
Well, that's a little bit of insight to our listeners. That's something to think about. So that's why they're so stubborn. Well, we're reaching the halfway point on my watch, which could be wrong. I'm not quite sure. But it's time to make another station identification. And you are listening to Then and Now, which is a program that attempts to bring, analyze how current events are affected by history so that you can have some appreciation as to why people do the things they do. There has to be some reason in it. It's almost like going back into biblical situations. What's the argument between the Palestinians and the Jews? And we are broadcasting from the Henry Ford Community College on 89.3 FM on your dial. And we're here making waves with Professor Viken Chaterian, who is our visiting professor here at the University of Michigan this week. And he is our guest. And you're going to be listening to many opinions expressed by our guest, myself, which are not necessarily those of anyone or associated with the Henry Ford Community College, because not only they don't know what we're going to be talking about, but we don't know what we're going to be talking about until we reach a point in the subject matter that makes our own curiosity want to know, gee, that's interesting. So, if you can, the stage is yours. Which part of this Caucasian nightmare would you like to elucidate on as to what separates these people and why? I began the program of the disillusionment of the empires. And if you notice, we didn't say anything about the Persian Empire because by that time Persia wasn't much of an empire. No one else had occupied it. But within Persia, I know we have Azeri Turks. We, of course, have some Armenians. Do we have other such peoples of the Caucasus that are part of what is today Iran? And they seem to be peaceful. They're not looking to partition Iran. Or are they?
There are some minorities which don't have much importance. There's some Talish on both sides of Azerbaijani.
And, are they Muslims or Christian?
They are Muslims. They are Persian-speaking minority who live in southern Azerbaijan, Lenkeran region.
So they speak Farsi.
They speak Farsi, that's right.
How about the Circassians that are known to have beautiful women? They're not Christian. They're Muslims, the Circassian?
That's right.
And what is their language group? A Caucasian language?
Caucasian language, yes.
What distinguishes this new thing I learned, the essence of Caucasian languages? Distinguishes a Caucasian language from non-Indo-European or Aryan language?
In fact, I'm not a linguist to give an interpretation of the differences and how these languages have been categorized together, but I know that...
Because you use the term so often, yeah. I've never heard anybody else say that.
Yeah, but I know that, for example, the Cherkess language is part of 2-3 other languages, which is considered to be central Caucasian languages.
Cherkess is a Turkish word for Circassian?
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted my listeners to... All of a sudden, a new thing came up.
The Russians also use the same...
Oh, they use the same term. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, people. There's a lot of us that are Armenian. We use a lot of words that... We always attributed to be Turkish, and then until we ran across so many Arabs, we found out that they're only words the Turks borrowed from Arabic. So
it's true. I mean, it's impressive.
So if you took the Arabic or Farsi out of Turkish, some people say it wouldn't be much left.
I mean, the influence of Arabic language over different Muslim peoples is very, very impressive.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was traveling in Uzbekistan, and I don't speak Uzbek, but I do speak Arabic. And I was impressed to see, when I was visiting a university, to see how many words I could identify, because I know Arabic. So it's impressive to see the influence of the Arabs
well,
as
because
far away as Uzbekistan?
Well, the essence is you have to pray in the Arabic language, so consequently they're forced to learn Arabic, but they only know it in terms of the prayers. I remember I was studying Arabic, and the teacher wrote on the wall, this was in Arabic, a horse is a noble animal. Let's see how that went in Arabic. Hassan, how did it go? Nabil Haywan. Uh-huh. And I told the teacher, Haywan, I know that word. I know what that means, animal. But here I thought, it's a word that crept into the Armenian language from Turkish, meaning animal. So Hassan is a Nabil Haywan, and I said, oh, boy, I know what that is. Anyway, so we have some, you're not able to explain what this the essence of Caucasian languages are.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a linguist of any position.
If you heard it, well,
for this,
you would think those that have Caucasian languages would be getting along a lot better with each other, wouldn't you think so?
Yeah, not always,
but
not
necessarily so. Yeah. So even that doesn't help them.
No.
Okay. Let's go into Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a Russian word meaning
mountainous Karabakh.
Mountainous Karabakh. Karabakh is a Turkish word which means black garden. In an Armenian, they call it Artsakh. So there you are, if you've not been totally confused. What's that all about?
So Artsakh or Karabakh or Nagorno-Karabakh
is a primarily Armenian district, which when Stalin was making his divisions, dividing up the world when he was secretary of the Communist Party, decided that this autonomous region of Armenians should be connected to Azeris, to the Republic of Azerbaijan. So these kinds of things were done, just like the Tatars of the Crimea were moved to Central Asia, such things like that. I guess these people had reasons for doing that, right?
Yes, at the time, Stalin gave
which is the reason for this conflict,
linked to economy, saying that the economy of Karabakh is linked to the lowlands around it.
I see.
Mainly inhabited by Azerbaijanis, so that's why it made sense from his perspective to keep the region within Azerbaijan. So,
but he also separated the Armenian district of Nakhichevan and gave it to, and it doesn't connect to Azerbaijan at all. Why did he do that?
Yes, I wanted to add that apart from this economic explanation, there was a political one.
Okay.
And at the time, Soviet Russia wanted to win the favors of Kemalist Turkey, wanted to win over Eastern peoples in Central Asia, in Persia and elsewhere, and by this kind of policies the idea was to do that exactly. So there was a political dimension to it.
So here's a region of Azerbaijan which used to be dominated with Armenians is now devoid of Armenians and not connected to Azerbaijan at all. Why are we talking about this, listeners? Because the Armenians and the Azeris are in a state of conflict over this region. And there is a CSEC, what is it, CSES, the Committee of Europe Security, I forget the exact.
Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, between the two sides.
And the people are wondering, why is that? Well, because of stuff like this. And then also, when the Bolshevik regime came to power, they created a little connection, a little peak, Parrot's Peak, that connects Turkey to Nakhichevan, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So they gave them a connection to tie the two. So this alienates people who look back, and their national identity is important to them. They say these things were wrong. We were wronged in the Balkans. That shouldn't have happened. That line shouldn't have been put there. This line shouldn't have put here. And we need to correct these things. And the world in general doesn't seem to want to say, let's have a conclave and let's talk about these things that were done to these very small people that either separated them or isolated them and try to solve these problems. The point of this program is to try to have the listener that's listening, who may not listen all the time, but at least whatever the subject matter is, you say, okay, this is why the Chechens are excited and don't want to be part of Russia.
Yeah,
it's not only that they're Muslims, but they have they're a different enculturated people too as well.
Yeah, exactly. As you said, the Chechens, like the Armenians of Karabakh, there was a time when they wanted to express their own political opinion. And they wanted to say, after decades of being repressed, not having the capacity and the ability to express our views, our desires, what we would like to do as a community, as the time of freedom came under Gorbachev, they wanted to go out in the streets and start their political organizations. And very fast, they talked about being independent. Now, of course, this position of Armenians of Karabakh or the Chechens did pose a number of problems. Like, for example, Azerbaijanis and Azerbaijan authorities did not want to lose territory. So that's obvious. Neither did the Russians. But me, I think, my point is, there was a possibility that in spite of these very radical demands by Armenians of Karabakh or Chechens, there was a possibility of sitting around the table and finding a solution. Up to the moment when the strong side decided to use force to repress the minorities by force. That's what happened in the case of Karabakh Armenians in 1988, only 3 weeks after the Karabakh Armenians officially declared their desire to join Soviet Armenia at the time. There were pogroms against Armenians in an Azerbaijani city, Sumgayit, and other pogroms followed. And already blood was spilled.
And the Russians had first sided with the Azeris, if I remember right.
That's right. At the time, it was still the Soviet Union. And as a result, we had a war, which ended in 1994.
It wasn't much of a war. I mean, it's really
Karabakh.
Attack on civilians. It's not as if the Armenians of Karabakh were a nation state.
But in the last years of the war, the Armenians of Karabakh, they had a well-organized army, and Azerbaijan was building its army, so they had, a war in a classical sense, with artillery, tanks, and warplanes taking part in military operations. So it was quite violent in the last period.
By that time, the Russians decided to support the Armenians against the Azeris.
That is true.
Yep. This is your area of expertise. The thing I wanted to say for our listening audience, and you might want to comment on it, which I think is important. Most people think that the Berlin Wall came down, the agitation for it, people trying to leave Germany, and then they went through Czechoslovakia, and they were getting out that way. Had its origins, what people don't remember, that this conflict that you're talking about, the Armenians went out into the street and said, look, we're not looking to liberate ourselves from the Soviet Union. Gorbachev said, let there be glasnost and perestroika, come out and say what it is that concerns you. We want to join communist Karabakh to communist Armenia, which is part of the Soviet Union. That's the sensible thing to do. That's what we want. We're not here claiming independence from the Soviet Union. Most people do not realize that when these demonstrations happened in Armenia, that was the crack in the wall. The crack in the wall was that when the Soviet tanks came to Armenia, they just looked at everybody. Nothing happened. So the essence is If it were not for what the Armenians did vis-a-vis this Karabakh dispute, which it exists to this day, the Eastern Europeans would never have taken, had the heart to do what they did, which eventually brought down the wall and separated, and eventually brought the Soviet Union down. This is my contention, and I was wondering what you thought about that. The average person doesn't understand that's what gave them heart in the Eastern Europe to pay, say, so to speak, thumb their nose at the Russians and to the German regime, East German regime, and the whole thing fell apart because they were not going to fight fire on their own people in the end.
Yeah. In Karabakh, in Armenia, they say that it was the Karabakh movement that brought down the Soviet Union. In Poland, they say that it was the Solidarność movement that brought down the Soviet Union. In Afghanistan, they say it was the war in Afghanistan that brought down the Soviet Union. I think on the Soviet wall, there were a number of cracks which eventually brought down the wall. And Karabakh was one of them.
I think you're absolutely right. There's no question about that. But the Polish thing didn't bring the Soviet Union down. The Karabakh issue and its relationship to what happened in Eastern Europe was almost instantaneous. It was within a year.
Yeah. But still,
they were not separated by a lot of time.
Yeah. But one can imagine that the Soviet Union could have survived without Karabakh and Armenia. Even if Armenia had taken its independence, the Soviet system could have survived elsewhere.
Have survived there. Ronald Reagan, all the Republicans in America think Ronald Reagan brought down the Soviet Union.
Yeah, another one. You see? There are different interpretations for history.
He was going to spend them into bankruptcy, like what's happening to the United States now. He said, I'm going to have Star Wars and the Russians can't possibly compete. And they knew they couldn't do it, and that brought the House of Cards down. But I know there are large geopolitical reasons for things that happen, as we're now talking about, but what interests me always is these little things that the average person listening to the news says, why are these people, why can't they get along? What's the essence of their disagreement? Why can't they be like regular, you know, upstanding from the Church of England, good Protestant young men and women with rationality, we'll deal with these problems. Because you're dealing with people that don't have that rationality. Whether it's Milosevic's Serbia or Abkhazia or Ossetia. I have not ever seen, I don't know an Abkhazian or an Ossetian, but these are the things that I think is interesting, because nobody, when you're listening to the news, can take the time to go into, except for even the Palestinian and Israeli conflict is, people make reference to it as being, there's a joke, it says, how long is that conflict? Somebody said it was 800 years, and it was in President, I think it was Senator Mitchell, who is now the major negotiator, said, this conflict is 800 years old, and he's saying this in Israel, and the Israeli responds back to him. He says, are you sure 800? He says, yeah, as if the 800 years was a long time. He says, that's nothing. That's relative history. Our conflict goes back further than that. I guess it goes back to Abraham. But actually, the major conflict with Palestinians and the Israelis goes back to the First World War. If that issue was resolved sensibly with the Arabs, we would have never had this problem that we have today.
Me, I don't share this opinion that conflicts go back to thousands of years, not even hundreds of years. I think conflicts are the result of policies of today. When you have people monopolizing power, not respecting their minorities, then you have all the reasons for having conflicts. When you have authorities which respect their minorities, they give cultural, social, economic space to their minorities to live peacefully, then there's no reason for conflict.
So, well, see, you come from Switzerland, right?
That's right, yes.
So in Switzerland, what do we have? Cantons. We have Swiss that speak French, Swiss that speak Italian, Swiss that speak German, Swiss that speak French. Is it like Canada? Everybody has to learn all five languages?
No.
At least in school.
No.
It's a wonder how the Swiss get along.
You have to learn the language of the region where you live.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to speak to learn major
English.
Languages. Sorry?
And then you have to learn English.
As a third language, yes. Or you can choose to learn Italian as a third language. But many people, of
which
course,
everybody says is easy to learn and beautiful.
It is beautiful. I don't know whether it's easy, but it's a really beautiful language.
That's what someone told me once, and I told that to an Italian contractor and I was working with. And he said, does that mean you think we're stupid? I said, why would you think that? I said, it's easy to learn. I'm only repeating what somebody else said. I have no idea. I know one thing, Arabic is difficult. So you are fluent in English, Arabic, Armenian.
That's right.
What else? Russian?
French.
French.
And I speak some Russian and German.
Ah, look at that, my God. Looks to our American listening audience. We got difficulty with English, never mind a second language.
You have to travel. That's the only secret.
Thank God the world has adopted English as its acceptable language. Only it's not acceptable in America. You have to learn Spanish here to get along now.
Excellent.
Go to Home Depot and all the signs are in Spanish. Well, his we only have a couple minutes left, and our station boss here is with us today, Jay Kornick. Your answer to resolve these conflicts is really the most important. It's Jay's question to you, and I think that's a great way to sum up the program.
It's not easy to resolve conflicts. That's for sure, understandable for everyone. But I think the first rule is that the sides don't go back to use violence to solve the conflict. First rule, because each time you use violence, then the conflicts get deeper and hatreds are revived again.
They become more current as opposed to being ancient.
More complex, absolutely, more complex to resolve. Second, to give time. Third, to understand the hopes and the fears of your opponent, what they are afraid of, and try to address that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I'm sure that speaks to Jay's heart as the right to the point.
Somebody has to figure it out.
That's it. Now, there's always a long story in even a short episode. And to learn this secret, I think with the Europeans, it should be a lot easier because you speak several languages. Knowing the language of other people is very helpful. It enculturates you in a way.
This is a very good point.
I know that because I know Armenian, and there's sometimes I may want to express myself, and there's just no way to do it in English like you can in Armenian. So knowing French, then somebody else can't tell you French fries are bad and we'll call them something else like freedom fries, and you begin to think how funny it is.
Just to go back to the question of ethnic groups and conflicts, in Switzerland, the majority of the population are German-speaking, and they do enormous efforts to learn the languages of the minorities, the French speakers and the Italians. And like this, they show to the other groups that we respect you. Mm-hmm. And we respect your language and we respect your culture. And I think in case this idea, in case it was picked up and used in other cases, majority groups would learn the culture, the language, and the specificities of minorities, this would be an enormous sign of respect.
Well, guess where we came to a close? At first, we were trying to find out what was the essence of all conflicts. Now we have the solution of not having conflicts, which I didn't think we would get to. So Professor Chitarian has done a wonderful job.
Thank
the majority should respect the culture and language of the minorities, hence understanding and therefore less conflict. And that's how we'll end our program. Thank you very much for listening to us today.
You have been listening to Then and Now, a pre-recorded program brought to you from 10 to 11 a.m. on the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of our talk show format entitled the WHFR Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events by your host, Ned Apigian, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear this program on the World Wide Web at www.whfr.fm. Thank you.
Hey, this is Bobby Bear Jr., and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.